Welcome everyone to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their enriching stories about lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host, and today we're exploring our non-fiction library of fascinating topics. So please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the next hour on Goldster Purpose, Passion and Grit, where we talk to guests about stamina, resolve and their drive to keep going. Now, my guest today knows casino life, the underbellies of society. And he's seen a bit of life and has recently had a birthday, but he still gets up every morning with a spring in his step on how to get his next ambition across the line. We're all a bit edgy like that in a way. He is a lawyer and he's worked cases in London, Las Vegas and beyond. And he's also the part-time chair of the Isle of Man Employment Tribunal. He is part of the establishment. But what exactly is the Isle of Man? It's not even British, is it? We will find out. And at this height of his youth, as you can see, he's waiting patiently for me to shut up. He plans to make a full-time career as a thriller writer. So we'll be talking about real-life high-stakes casinos, black market gambling, Formula One racing, drugs trade espionage, shipping piracy, sports fixing, and his new hero, Inspector Todd Ratso Holtom. And I have a question for the beautiful people in the audience, and it's a big guessing question because no one quite knows the answer, but how much do you think is gambled on a one-day cricket match? How much do you think is gambled on a one-day cricket match? Just put an answer in your chat and we'll discuss it and see whether it's anywhere near right, because I got it totally wrong. My guest knows roughly the answer. Maybe he's even placed a bet himself. Welcome, Doug Stewart, to Goldster Inside Story.
Terrific to be here.
Now, you say terrific to be here, but where on earth are you, Doug? That blue sky, palm trees?
Well, it's not the Isle of Man, I have to say. It's Limassol in Cyprus today.
And are you doing an underworld drugs case there, or are you vacationing, as they say in America?
No, I'm not vacationing. No, I'm pretty hard pressed at the moment with a new book coming out, but I've also been doing some research for the next book, and getting some ideas from friends here. I've had two new book ideas since I've been here in the last 2 weeks.
Oh, that is absolutely brilliant. I just like this idea that you've had this sterling career as an international lawyer, and now you've just had a fairly big birthday. You've turned 30, let's say, and you're planning your new life. But let's start with you being. Let's start with lawyers generally, because okay. We're hearing a lot about lawyers at the moment, particularly with the post office scandal. And there were lawyers pursuing these poor postmasters and mistresses in these country places and ruining lives. Are you a good guy lawyer or a bad guy lawyer?
When I practiced in the west of England and then in London, I was very much regarded as on the side of the good guys. I did a lot of work with Esther Anson's That's Life program. I was a consultant to the program. That was obviously helping people in distress. That was instinctively my side. I have worked for insurance companies, but I would never do something that, in my view, was unconscionable. And some of the behavior that we've seen in the Horizon scandal does question the judgment of some of the lawyers involved, I think.
So what do you do if you're a lawyer and somebody wants to hire you to do something? What is a line? Can you give us an example of a line you won't cross?
Well, I did have somebody when I was actually pretty inexperienced, and they said, look, which of these two lies is the better one to tell the judge? And I said, there's the door.
but if a big corporation is hiring you for something, and we all know that in government and corporations, you have to go a bit one way and a bit the other. Would there be something that you would say, no, I'm out of here?
I would not do anything knowingly unethical. My boss in London was a very brilliant lawyer, but he got hired by a huge American corporation, and he was caught with a transit van smuggling all the dangerous documents into France to hide them. And he was caught, and he was arrested, and sadly, he committed suicide. It's a lesson of how you can be suckered into something. It was also part of the theme of the Grisham book, The Firm.
Yes.
How the young lawyer suddenly finds himself out of his depth with big money.
Yes. And talking about big money, we have got a couple of guesses in. Thank you, everybody. Josie Morgan says $1 million. Wilson, pounds or dollars, the same. A bet in one day on a cricket match. And Marguerite Angelais says $5 million. We won't say a thing there. We'll just keep guessing, keep guessing. That is not a right answer, but there's a rough right answer. Just before we move off the ethical side of this, what should we, you know, humble people in the street do if we get a threatening letter from a bad lawyer that could come from a gas company, from the government, from something like that? Because if we go and get our own lawyer, we'll be bankrupt before you can blink.
Well, obviously, the Consumer's Advice Service, the Advice Bureau, is there. Take a deep breath. Don't panic is the first thing, obviously. Almost everybody will have some wise friends that can maybe give them some help if you don't go to a lawyer. Legal aid is now so limited that it's difficult to get a good lawyer on your side because it's expensive. So I think ask around and think very carefully. You may find now on the web that other people have been bullied in the same way, and you might then be able to get together.
And in the States, they call that a class action suit, don't they? If you have
They do.
Do we have them here?
Yes, sort of, yes. Not quite the same as America. I joined one once against American Express, I think it was, and after 3 or 4 years litigation, I got a check for $17.
And did it cost you anything?
It didn't cost me anything, though, so it was a bonus. I could probably have a gin and tonic anyway.
Oh, that's brilliant. Let's go right back to the beginning, because we've talked about your legal career, your glittering legal career, which we're going to stick on for a bit. But did you always want to be a lawyer, or did you want to do what you're doing now and become Ian Fleming or John le Carré?
Yeah.
The answer to that is both. I don't know why I decided to become a lawyer, but I told my father when I was 13, I thought I'd like to be a lawyer. And while I was at school, I was fortunate enough to meet a couple of famous authors. And they gave me the inspiration. I had a terrific English teacher who said, look, I think you've got some talent for writing. You know, one day you may be able to develop it. Meet my brother, Geoffrey Housel. Now, at the age I was then, it meant nothing, but turned out he was a legendary thriller writer, particularly of the book Rogue Mail. And those sort of things stick with you. And so when I got to university, I helped on the university newspaper and did interviews and wrote articles and so on. And once I got married and had children, I thought, well, you know, I don't want to watch Christmas TV every evening over in December. I'll write a book. And I never looked back ever since.
And you wrote a book then, did you, over that Christmas?
On Boxing Day, and it probably took me about 2 years to finish it, I think, and lots of rewrites, lots of rejections, 16 rejections, and then it was accepted by Robert Hales.
Oh, brilliant. So, and we're talking, what, 40 years ago, is that?
I think it must be 40, probably 43 years, I think, now.
Because you just had a birthday, haven't you, Doug? So are you able to tell us what that birthday was?
Well, it's higher than any of my cricket scores, I can tell you that. It's 80.
So 80?
80, yeah, and no intention of slowing down.
That's what I like to hear. The word retire is not in your vocabulary. But if you're 80 now, going back, 60, 50 plus years, you've just graduated as a lawyer. You've joined a law firm. What sort of work did you do?
I fell in love with litigation immediately. I was hopeless at conveyancing. That's, you know, doing housing transactions. When I moved on from my first law firm, they said, well, look, you really ought to do one conveyance. Do it on your own house. When I moved, and I was by then back in the West Country, the senior partner wrote to me and said, dear Mr. Stewart, I'm sorry this document is such a mess. It was sadly mishandled by a former member of this firm.
That was you, was it?
That was me.
So what is litigation exactly?
Well, I did a little bit of criminal law, but basically it was sorting out civil claims before a high court judge. Could be accident claims, it could be commercial disputes. But particularly as I got more experience, I became more and more international with commercial issues. And also, I had a great interest in looking after people with spinal injuries.
Okay.
So I worked at Stoke Mandeville certainly every month, and I used to see Jimmy Savile there sometimes of that ilk. Then, of course, that liking litigation led me into helping Esther Anson's program, That's Life, with so many of her, the legal issues that arose.
Just give us an example of a case that you got involved with very, very quickly, of how that all evolves.
I suppose the most famous case I did at the time was, it'll be stretching your memory a bit, Humphrey. I represented the whole egg industry when Edwina Curry, as the government minister, slandered the egg industries by saying all the eggs had salmonella.
Yes.
And of course, all the poor egg producers were going bankrupt, and I represented the entire industry and was very influential in forcing her resignation the same day that I sued her with 20 different writs.
Goodness. So would that have been what we discussed a moment earlier, a class action case by the egg industry?
Yeah, it wasn't regarded as a class action, but it was just a bit like the French farmers are doing, you know. It was a mass protest from around the country.
Yes.
And all the egg producers.
And of course, it shows us that, you know, one wrong word, off-the-cuff word by a politician can actually change the world for a lot of people in a bad way. Yeah.
And in the case of Edwina Curry, she went out 3 days later and doubled down on it.
Oh, did she?
Yeah.
Well, she said she doubled down and said that she was right.
Yeah, more or less, yes.
Goodness. And she wasn't right, was she?
I don't think she was. And the government settled.
And we're still eating eggs, or at least I am. I don't know. And then at some stage you moved lock, stock and barrel to the gambling capital of the world, Las Vegas.
Correct.
Tell us, what is Las Vegas?
That's the thing to do when you retire as a lawyer. So yeah. I left my firm where I was the senior partner in London. And my wife and I looked at 14 different cities in America, and the best deal that we could find was living in a beautiful part of Las Vegas, away from the Strip, but with wonderful views of the valley at night.
And what did you say? Did you go out there hired by a company, or did you just wing it?
I was retained by Lloyd's underwriters to be their eyes and ears in America. Who was going to sue them next? Which was very, very interesting, because obviously they're interested in getting their premiums right. So I was keeping an eye on what was going on with everybody out there. That was very, very interesting. Being in Vegas, I got intrigued with the gambling world. I'd had some experience in London because I was friendly with the casino manager, who had a few yarns to tell me. And it all led to writing a book about casinos.
Okay, just the London gambling world, was that the world that was set around those Mayfair clubs with Lord Lucan and John Aspinall, the zoo owner, and people like that?
Yes, it absolutely right. It was. Not that I ever met any of that crowd at all. I think they were very big, heavy gamblers. I think I was probably what the casino managers would have called a flea.
A flea? So
a
what
flea
you mean,
rather
you,
than a whale.
You didn't bet enough.
Yes, the big guys are called whales. Whales.
Yes. And so I think it was called the Claremont Club, wasn't it?
I think it was, yes, where Lord Lucan would play until he had to disappear.
And then, but to get into one of those, you had to be a whale. So how much did you have to have ready to spend?
Well, you know, I know people. I watched people gambling, not in London, but I watched people betting $500,000 a hand.
Well, poker or pontoon or something?
That was actually baccarat.
Baccarat. $500,000.
Yes, a hand.
That's a whale.
That is a whale.
And they can afford to lose it. Talking of whales, we have got two guesses so far, and now we're on to gambling, is how much do you think is bet on a one-day cricket match? This is our thing, but you can get an idea of the sort of amounts from what Doug is talking about here. And then you were in Las Vegas. Tell us firstly, describe Las Vegas to us.
Well, everybody assumes if you live in Vegas that you're probably sort of living somewhere underneath a roulette wheel, which it's not like that at all. It's a city, I think, bigger than anywhere in the UK except London. So, you know, that starts to put it in perspective that you can live there and the gambling world is down on the strip. The rest of it is relatively normal, not entirely normal. It can't be entirely normal. So we lived out on the edge. It was a lovely way of life, with a pretty good climate most of the year. Going into the strip, well, you would see huge success. You'd see all aspects of human life, from those who had lost their shirt through to those that had just won their 100 million or whatever it was. When I was there, somebody won 73 million on a slot machine.
What?
Yeah.
Well, and how much would they put in?
Oh, $3. I mean, they'd been playing for several hours, they'd have put in a lot more, but it would only have cost them $3 to win that.
And what does it come out? How does it come out of the slot machine?
No, you a lot of big gorillas come around and guard you when that happens, and you get taken somewhere and they'll feed you champagne. And the tragic thing was that this woman won it the weekend. I'd been predicting the power was going to come. And she said, "And it's not going to change my life." I couldn't believe it. I said, "Well, you send me a check then. It'll change mine."
But the work you were doing for Lloyd's, to sort of keeping you their scout, as it were, for cases. Yeah. The economy of Las Vegas is the gambling industry, isn't it?
Oh, undoubtedly.
So you would have had to have got, you must tell us more secrets about it then, because you must be highly knowledgeable.
Well, I was retained by Las Vegas gambling company to look after their prospects for moving into the UK, and also an English casino group moving into Vegas. So I saw a bit on both sides, not as their main corporate lawyer, but as a consultant, because I was living there. So yeah, I learned an awful lot. And one of my contacts was a professional cheat, and he helped me quite a bit with my book, Deadline Vegas, and also Dead Fix, with his ideas and his experience. He's well known as a professional cheat. I mean, he makes no secret of it.
So you say that with just two words, but can you give us a little bit more? How does a professional cheat operate? They walk into a casino, and then what happens?
Well, at the roulette table, it's people who don't know the layout, but if you sit at one end of the roulette table, if you're very cunning, and say number 36 comes in, one of the highest numbers, the highest number, then while the people aren't looking, you hope they're not spotting, you put a winning chip onto that number past posting after you've seen the ball nestled in number 36. And so, whereas you had no bet on at the last minute, you're going to win £1,000, £10,000, whatever. There are a lot of tricks like that.
You'd have to be super fast to do that, wouldn't you?
There are very clever people out there, but the casinos, with all their cameras and spotters, will sooner or later catch you and give you a right thumping, I would think.
And if you're a well-known professional cheat, like the source for your thrillers there, is he allowed to walk around the casinos, or do they just ban him at the door?
Very interesting. When he was helping me, there wasn't the facial recognition software that is used now. Mm. And the facial recognition software will get Humphrey at Hawksley wearing a beard and a dark glasses and with his hair long. Yeah. They'd spot that a mile off. They'd, oh, that's old Humphrey again.
So that was cheating at the roulette wheel. And how do you cheat at cards? Or how do you count the cards?
Oh, the card games, a professional cheat will try and sit at the first base on the semicircular table, and they can, sometimes with a bit of corruption from the dealer, see the cards as they're coming out. It's quite a well-known scam. In fact, the casino manager I knew in London said their biggest horror was always the risk of a corrupt member of their staff teaming up with a member of the public.
Oh, so there would be an arrangement between the croupier, is that what they call the croupier,
yep,
and the gambler?
Yep.
And then they would split the proceeds.
Split the proceeds, yes.
And what happens if either a court in one of these big Las Vegas casinos?
Well, there's some horror stories of a sort of dungeon room where you get taken to. In the old days, no doubt you were probably given a severe beating if you survived. These days, I think they just terrify you. Occasionally, they will prosecute.
Okay, you mean so when you say terrifying dungeons, the Las Vegas was built on organized crime, wasn't it?
Oh, it certainly was. Yes.
Is it still run by organized crime?
And the casinos, I don't think they are. No, there is still organized crime in Vegas.
Yeah.
In other industries, I think. But the casino industry is now so corporate and global that I don't think they've got the shares in the companies the way they used to control it.
Okay. So you would feel, or you did feel, quite safe doing what you did in Vegas?
I thought Vegas was a very safe city, less safe now. I mean, people used to say, well, it was a lot safer in the old days. When the mob ran it, they wouldn't have any street crime, and muggings and so on would never happen. Now there's been much more crime in Las Vegas because it's police-controlled rather than mob-controlled.
Oh, okay. I see. And were you there when it was mob-controlled or police-controlled?
I did. I was there in those days, but I wasn't living there then. Like, by the time I arrived, it was pretty much being cleaned up.
Yes. And give us an example, Doug, of one of the cases, legal cases, that you did there that you found particularly interesting, or maybe that you fed into one of your books.
I didn't handle a specific case involving Vegas. I did help a Scottish guy who came to me and said he'd been given my name from somebody because his wife's brooch or something worth $50,000 had been stolen. And so I went to the casino and met the security manager, and he said, "Don't you worry, your client will get it back within 3 days." So I don't know how their justice system worked, but it was returned.
Oh, my God. Returned or the casino just gave out $50,000 to make...
No, they got the actual piece back.
The actual money back.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there was a brooch or a necklace or something like that. Yes. Yeah, whatever it was, they got it back. Oh, yeah.
That's. I think we've got... We have another guess. Emma, because some cricket fans are whales, in terms of money, I would say betting can go between 2 to 4 million. 2 to 4 million. Okay, so what we've got, Doug, so far is 5 million from Marguerite, 2 to 4 from Emma, and Josie is 1 million. This is how much is bet on a day-long cricket match? Put your answer in. Nobody knows the exact answer because, of, as we're talking about, things of both underworld and overworld. But put it in, and we're going to discuss it at the end of that. And let's talk a little bit about that now, Doug. You have, I don't know whether it was when you were in Vegas or whatever, you became involved in this whole sports fixing world and did a book on it.
I did. I wrote Dead Fix, which is fiction, but heavily inspired by fact. I've had a love of cricket all my life. I was a pretty useless player, but I loved the game. And I had many contacts. I was on the Council of the Lords Tablers, which was a cricket-dominated charity. And so through that, I met people, and they said, do you realize, you know, there's quite a lot of fixing going on? And this was in the probably mid to late 90s, and then obviously since then. And it, the scandal did burst with the South African team in deep trouble. Since then, three Pakistani players have been sent to jail. There's been at least one, if not two, murders of players involved in the match fixing. I was talking only last night to somebody here on Cyprus who was saying that referees around Europe need police protection because of threats against them for match fixing. Corruption is everywhere. Tennis, snooker, you name it. All sports are at risk from this huge, huge industry.
Give us an example of a match fix, say in cricket. If somebody drops a ball, somebody misses the wicket, what happens? What's the arrangement? Well,
spot fixing would be when the bowler tells the bookie or his contact, I will bowl the third ball as a wide. And somebody will take a bet on that, and obviously they're going to win it. Bigger scale fixing would be to fix the result of an entire match, as has happened. That's very difficult because you've got to get everybody on board pretty much, especially the captain. But they will say, well, we'll have bets on what the score will be at the lunch interval or the tea interval. And that can be manipulated rather more readily by skillful players. And sometimes a cricketer, a batsman might throw his wicket to get out to help a bookie. So there are all sorts of permutations. It's absolutely horrible. In tennis, the two players can sometimes fix the entire match, and that has happened. Sometimes they say, well, you know, the bet is there will be two sets each at some stage, and they can fix that. Nobody really loses that, and then they play the last set for real. I learned all this because there's an expert working at Lords in their crime prevention, and I didn't realize that there's a whole committee that meets to discuss all about different sports fixing. And they work with the bookmakers to help them, and each helps the other on prevention or convictions if there is fixing.
So we are talking about a Lord's Test match, a Wimbledon tennis match, a Twickenham rugby match. This is mainstream big sport.
The cricket was certainly, at the time when I wrote the book, at the highest levels of cricket. Tennis, there's been stories, rumours about high level, up to sort of Wimbledon standard, but there's an awful lot of tennis played in slightly lower tier tournaments where there's still very heavy betting.
And how does it work? I mean, if you're fixing, say, just as you said, that the third ball will go wide from the bowler, and then are there bets on that particular over or that particular bowl? And how many people are involved?
Well, there'll be people right through to the corrupt person placing the bet probably in Dubai or Mumbai or somewhere. We're just going to try and expand on that for you. One of the scams that they watch for, and at Laws they'll have somebody watching the crowd to see somebody perpetually using their mobile phone. There was a lot of fixing involving that. So the person, you know, at Lords would see the ball bowled and know what happened, and he could get that information through saying, there's just been a wicket, before the pictures reached the bookmakers out in the Far East. And therefore you could get a bet on out there, knowing what had happened before the bookmaker. Mm-hmm.
So that's it. And so they have Lords and Wimbledon, I presume, and they all have their own, you know, anti-fixing units, do they?
Yes, they do.
That look at this. I mean, this is, people, Geeta says, wow, we've got a lot of suitor, and yet cricket seems such a civilised game.
Well, one likes to think it is, yes. And obviously, how endemic the problem is now, I don't know, but there is such huge money involved, what the players earn and so on, and how it's controlled by big business. It's very hard for me to judge as an outsider just what is going wrong. Not very much now. I think probably we've had the high watermark of it, but I really don't know for sure.
You talk about the money involved, but soccer is even more, isn't it? Do they fix the soccer matches in the same way?
Oh, there's been so many stories of particularly fixing referees, but sometimes we've had stories of goalkeepers letting in goals deliberately and so on in the English Premier League.
This is in Premier League.
There's been I won't go into the details on air because it wouldn't be appropriate. But in Eastern Europe, particularly, referees and linesmen and so on have been known to be bent and able to help fix a suitable result and get richly rewarded.
So when we're all sort of glued to the Premier League Cup final or the World Cup or the Wimbledon final or something, we now, those listening to this show, now know that it might not all be that it seems.
It might not be, but there's a very good chance it will be all kosher, but you just can't be sure.
Goodness. Ewan Grant says, hi, Ewan, very high figure. This is the guest that we're having, which I think we're going to reveal now. I think we should. Very high figure, not least because of the syndicates just mentioned. Do you know any of those syndicates, Ewan? Duncan Stewart. If you include under-the-counter betting in India, and it's a popular game involving India, it will be well over $250 million for a one-day game. Thank you for that. $250 million. The others have been betting. I don't think we had one higher than 10. Ewan Grant, a lot of scams were run online from Singapore a few years ago. Perhaps they have cracked down. Singapore does not mess about when it chooses to. Anything on Singapore that you know about, Doug?
No, I love it. I've worked there quite a bit over the years and I've written about it, but no, I don't know anything about Singapore and fixing. It's basically dominated by India and involving Dubai and Indians, possibly Pakistanis.
So just to sort of nail this in my mind, if I wanted to put a bet on, say, the Wimbledon final or something and heard that so-and-so was going to put a ball into the net at such and such stage, I would then get in touch with somebody that would get in touch with somebody that would go to Dubai and whatever, would take my money. And then if that happened, they would credit it back to me.
Yes, you get them. That's right. You get your winnings. We're not talking about people putting their bets on at William Hill or Ladbrokes.
Yeah.
They are. Obviously, they are. But they're, you know, the ones that are headlined in my book. You bet they win. You're betting, but you don't know what they've fixed. And we're talking of the black market illegal gambling, which goes on through Dubai and India in particular. And the expert that helped me with my book said, if you said it was $1 billion on a one-day game involving India and Pakistan or something at that level, You would not be wrong.
There we go. We have the answer, everybody. That's $1 billion. You would not be wrong. It could be more. It probably wouldn't be less. Bet on a one-day game. And that's the all the betting or just the sort of fixed, the illegal betting, or that's everything?
People, Indians aren't allowed to bet, but it's, they obviously do. There's all sorts of structures organising the gambling. Yeah. So you've got that aspect. But there's people at the top who know what's going to happen, or believe they do, will have their bets on in all that and will win heavily. And if it goes wrong, then the player who should have fixed it may get the bullet.
And it says, and this is a terrifying purpose, passion, and grit show you're giving us, Doug. When we were talking before, you told me a story at one of the cases you were on or something, and everybody knows that this is a fake backdrop I've got here with beautiful books in it. And you went and on somebody's private jet, tell us about it, and you saw a similar fake backdrop to this. What happened?
Yeah, this wasn't me on the private jet, unfortunately. I wish it had been. I haven't been on a private jet. I've been on private prop once, but private jet, no. That's for the future. When I've sold a couple more million books, then maybe. But this lawyer friend of mine who worked at a very high level in Washington was advising Mr. Adnan Khashoggi, a very famous Middle Eastern billionaire, I guess. And he had to go to a meeting somewhere in the Emirates or out there. And this private jet from Mr. Khashoggi arrived in Washington. He was the only person on board except for the crew in this 707 jet. And so he wandered around and he got to what was presumably the relaxing room, but with a wonderful array of books, just like you got behind you, beautiful leather bound and gold braiding and whatever. He loved books, so he just pulled one of them out. He opened it up, and it was 12 months Playboy magazine inside.
No works of Shakespeare or Walter Scott or anything like
that. Nothing is ever about
there. Oh, what a story. Gita here says, I thought a billion, but I thought it would be too crazy to say. Thing is the thing you never say, Gita. Well done. We will give you a sort of vicarious thing that you and Grant to everybody. Yeah, Gita, well thought of. And Emma says a billion. That's why they're whales. But now I just need to, a couple of things. You are in the Isle of Man, and that is it a dodgy place? It's an island in the middle of the Atlantic, and it belongs to no one. What is it?
Yeah, you're right. It's independent of the UK, totally independent. It has its longest-running parliament in the world, longest-running continuous parliament, Tynwald. It's been described, I think it was the Daily Mail, described the Isle of Man as 88,000 alcoholics clinging to a rock in the middle of the Irish Sea.
Why do you live there?
Why do I? We left Vegas. We moved to Cyprus for a while, but we needed to give my young daughter, as she then was, a bit more stability in her life with better schooling. So we moved to the Isle of Man, and I was offered the chance to continue my writing there and also to become a part-time member of the judiciary.
Yeah, and you are the chair or part-time chair of the Employment Tribunal, is that right?
Employment and Equality Tribunal now, yes. It covers all the equality rights as well as employment law.
So give us an idea. You can't tell us any individual cases because you are still a practicing member of the establishment. Give us an idea of what you do.
Well, if somebody at work knows that the boss is money laundering or something like that through the company, or that their clients are, and he blows the whistle and then gets fired, then he would come to our tribunal and we would say, he deserves compensation for losing his job for whistleblowing.
And the main industry in the Isle of Man is money, isn't it?
That is a pretty simple headline. Obviously, interesting, it is one of the world's main centres for online gambling.
Oh.
So it's run from there.
Oh, all these billion-pound cricket bets are all run from your backyard, are they?
Not really, no. It's nearly all online roulette, online poker. We have PokerStars there. Well, it's the world's biggest poker company. This company's like that that run their things for presumably good business reasons, tax reasons, and it then goes around the world from there.
Goodness. And you are trained as a lawyer in the UK.
Yes.
But you practiced in the US. So you practice in the Isle of Man, which is not UK jurisdiction, am I right?
Yeah, the law in the Isle of Man is probably 70 to 80% similar to the UK. And the employment law is probably 80-85% the same. So I was allowed to do that. I couldn't actually practice as a lawyer, appearing in front of myself as a lawyer.
Right, okay.
Rather curious, but that's the way it is.
And the Isle of Man, before we move away, I understand the Isle of Man still allows flogging and hanging. Is that right?
I think you're a little bit out of date there, Humphrey. I'll say goodbye. The birching ended about 30 years ago, I think.
Oh, what about the hanging?
No, we haven't had a good hanging on the Isle of Man for a long, long time.
Oh, okay. I always knew the birching was around. But I want to now go back to you told us these incredible stories of which you have put into your books, which we're going to nail down that in a minute. Early on in your career, you wrote a book that with a mainstream publisher that got pulled after lots of legal action. Just tell me what happened there and how you got through it.
Yes, the book was called The Dallas Dilemma. It's probably still available. It's going to be republished again. Excuse me, the air's a bit dry here. Give me a second.
That's all right, you're in the tropics.
So the Dallas Dilemma was all about an arthritis drug that went wrong. And I'd done a lot of litigation about four pharmaceuticals. And I read the book, and there were two words in it that a major drug giant in the USA took exception to. What I'd written was entirely true, entirely justifiable. But my London publishers and I were faced on a Monday morning with a letter. They wanted 10 million from me and 10 million from the publisher. And although we could prove the truth, they said, it's cheaper just to pulp the book. So it was pulled, but is now being republished by me with the offending words taken out.
You say the offending words taken out, it might not be good enough. You might get another letter with 10 million inflation, so 100 million.
Yes. Oh, God, heaven forbid. I mean, it certainly spoiled my whole day when I got that letter. It was awful.
And what does that do? I mean, you know, you've worked, we all know, people work very hard on their books and selling it. You talked about the rejections. When something like that happens, what does it do to a writer's career?
Well, very interesting. I mean, it didn't in my case. It could make the career take off. I mean, some people have managed to get notorious anyway. By what they've written, maybe Prince Harry sold a lot of books by being very controversial. For me, I learned a lesson to be even more careful. My book had been passed by the libel lawyers for the publishers as well as by me. We knew we could prove it, but standing up to litigation in a Los Angeles court, as it would have been, was just not worth the candle when they could just pull the book and start, leave it to me to start again if I wanted, which I did.
And did you get another book published with the same publisher, or did they want nothing more to do with you after that?
No, they were very supportive of me, actually. They did publish another book for me. Yes. No hard feelings.
So I want to focus on this incredible sort of legal life you've had, from the clubs of Mayfair to the Las Vegas underworld and sports fixing and thing, of how you fed that into your thrillers. I want to talk particularly about the Ratso series, because that's your latest series. So Hard Place.
Yes.
What is that, and what experiences did you put into it?
One of my contacts was a former chief constable in England, and he introduced me to his son, who was a metropolitan detective. So one was a big boss, the other one was actually out on the street dealing with London crime. And he told me this amazing story, which became Hard Fix. I changed it quite a bit, but it was about an Albanian drug king. Drug baron.
Yeah.
And it was based on truth. I mean, they're almost untouchable. Albanian gangsters control the drug industry over much of the UK now.
Yes.
They've taken over from the people we've heard of in the past, like the Crays and the Richard Stearns and the Yardies. Yeah. No, it's Albanians that are really very, very... tough people to deal with.
Yeah, they are very, very tough. I've reported on them a lot, both in Kosovo, Albania, and elsewhere. But now tell us your hero that you've decided on creating a character to run through this series. Tell us about Ratso.
Ratso is a tough London cop. He loves sport. He is always, in each book, there's three going to be out by middle of March, and the fourth one on the way after that. They all have an international theme. He is not the cozy detective sucking a pencil and wondering what to do next for some old biddy dead down the road. This is all very heavy, hard crime, big money involved always.
Right. Is that, when you say hard crime, we've had a few discussions here of whether it's noir or cozy or hard boiled or whatever. Yours is what you call hard crime.
I think hard boiled probably.
Hard boiled.
I put action and adventure rather than police procedural, really. Although they are procedural in the sense that Ratso goes from zero to solving the problem by the end of the book.
Yes.
But procedural only in that sense. I mean, it's really action and adventure and exciting stuff. And so much has been created by the ideas from knowing real-life detectives who are at the sharp end.
Yes, that's... we've got some comments here just before we get back to Dead Fix. Emma says, isn't the island a tax haven? It is a tax haven, isn't it, Isle of Man? Doug?
Yeah, they don't like to go on the tax haven. It's a business efficiency centre or something, but it's certainly got very advantageous tax.
Well, we call that a tax haven.
That's why I'm there, unfortunately. I'm not there for...
I haven't asked you that.
My almost next-door neighbours, Lady Baroness Moan and Doug Barrowman, who are in all the news there.
They're the PPE scandal couple that we're reading.
Yes, that's right. Yes, they live about half a mile from me.
What, and you go to cocktail parties and dancing at each other's mansions?
Absolutely not. No, I think if they went past in their Rolls Royce, I'd have to doff my cap.
Gita says, Ray Birchingham hanging, you sound disappointed, Humphrey. I always like a good story, Gita. Ewan Grant says... what is this? www.fintrail.com. Run an online book club series. I think they might be interested in hearing from Mr. Stewart and Humphrey, of course. That's fintrail.com. We must remember that. Joe will have a copy of that. Ewan also says, from memory, I'm that old. And Doug's a young man, we must remember. He's just had a birthday. Channel Islands had death sentences issued well into the 1970s. Goodness. But never carried out since the mainland ended it. Yes, so 1970s, so maybe I'm...
I think probably the Isle of Man was somewhere around about Between 1950 and 1970, yes.
Yes. I've just put A Hard Place into the chat there, and I think it is free at the moment. So you can go onto that chat and you can download it for nothing. Why is it free, Doug?
Because I wanted people to get into the series. So I've had advice from a wonderful professional marketeer called Rebecca. And Rebecca said, why don't you give away the first book in the series free and hope people then go into number two and number three and number four? Seemed a great idea. It doesn't cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
Give it a go. And I thought, yeah, great. Good.
Yeah.
Do it.
That's it. Geeta, my cousin has written a book featuring cricket in India and young techies. He would love this interview. Could he find it on YouTube somewhere? Yes, Geeta. Joe will tell you, and it will become a podcast as well. So we'll get in touch with you about that. Emma, Isle of Man, I think you're talking about. It must be an interesting place to live. Perhaps writing a story about such places with its characters would be interesting. Would that be hard-boiled, Doug, or cozy crime if you did something?
There's a very good author called Chris Ewan that used to live on the Isle of Man. He's now left, and I think moved to the west of England. But he has written books about the Isle of Man. Very good, very good crime fiction.
Oh, okay.
I'll have
a look at that. We're very much into communities and how people end up killing each other in that community.
Right.
Dead Fix that you've mentioned is about the gambling that we talked about. Is it with Ratso as well? Is that correct?
Yes, that's Ratso. And that involves India, Mumbai, USA, and the UK.
Yeah. So the backdrop to that is exactly what you explained to us there about how the corrupt gambling, corrupt fixing world works in sport.
Certainly does. It starts off with the tragedy, and then you realize why the tragedy occurred and who was involved in the brutality that was.
Okay. And so if anybody wants that, if you click on the link that goes to Hard Place, you'll be able to find Dead Fix from that link as well. And Deadly Hush is coming out in a few weeks' time, is that right?
That's on the 11th of March. And that involves what appears to be a serial killer picking off members of the LGBT community. But as ever with Ratso, nothing's ever quite what it seems. It might look like a simple serial killer with a hate vengeance or something, but as ever, it's something very different.
And you said in our sort of pre-show chat that you feel that you might be retiring from the law and want to now become a full-time thriller writer at this young age. You have plans to become the next Ian Fleming on this, or the who are the great sporting authors that we've had?
Cool.
Dick Francis.
I remember Michael Atherton, the England cricket captain, saying there's a dearth of good books about fiction in cricket. My role as a tribunal chairman ends in 2 years this month. And so I've got to do something else. I can't do nothing. I just love being busy and doing something constructive. Yeah. So I'm really going to develop my writing career and put it into, fifth gear now rather than jogging along in second.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And tell me, do you ever take a flutter yourself at the tables?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely, yes. It's very exciting. Enjoy it. Yes.
Well, what game do you play?
Typically, I'll play roulette. The odds aren't as good as playing baccarat or blackjack. The odds in blackjack are better, but I find it a hard game to win.
And
baccarat's good, but it, you can play that if you're brain dead.
And in your last flutter, did you win or lose?
The last one, I lost, and the last four before that, I won. My aim is to win four times out of five.
So did you, because we were talking about how much people bet and as a whale or what did you call yourself, a flea?
A flea, yes.
Did you lose 500,000 or £5?
What? 50 pence, yeah, no, a few pounds, yeah. No, it's not serious, but I do enjoy the heat of the chase.
The heat of the chase. Wait there for a moment, Doug. I have to tell people what is coming up. And I just want to say to the wonderful members out there that things are a little in the air at the moment. All great ideas go through change, and Golster's in the midst of one now. I've ridden through many of mine in my BBC and publishing career, people change, market changes, that sort of thing. Lucinda and I are talking every day with plans and ideas, and Golster is listening to members, so don't hesitate in telling Golster what you want, and Lucinda and I will try and make it happen. For the moment, though, I have a thing saying keep calm and carry on, which is what we're doing. So on Thursday, I'm going to be with Lucinda. I'm going to be Lucinda's guest on Inside Story in an audience show from Riverstone in Fulham. We're going to be talking about youth, dreams, writing, reporting, adventures, like Doug has just told us. And of course, I won't resist quizzing the lovely and fascinating Lucinda about her own fabulous career. I can never be just a guest. On Friday, I am with the guru of our political system. Do you get as confused as I am which part is saying what and what it all means? Or does it matter? It should, I suppose, if we live in a democracy. Join me for clarity and questions with Professor Tim Bale, who is an expert on all of this. February the 15th, Lucinda is with Jean Briggs, a stalwart of the Crime Writers Association and author of a brilliant series of Charles Dickens as a detective. That's a fictional series. Lucinda, of course, is Dickens's great-great-great-granddaughter. That's three greats. I remembered that. And February the 16th, Golster takes you to the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. Yes, to talk to Kelly Dorji on his meditation book, The Hidden Rainbow, and of the literary festival that he organizes in Bhutan every year. This will be a wonderful and truly fascinating story. He will be talking to us from the capital of Bhutan, which is Thimphu. That's a good one to finish this promotional slate with. Ever been to Bhutan, Doug?
No, I haven't. And I can't say it's even on my list, but maybe it should be by the sound of
it. I think
it should.
I will tell Kelly to invite you to the Druk, I think it's called the Druk Echoes Literary Festival, to talk about Deadly Hush. How about that?
That sounds terrific.
Yes. And we'll have a Golster member will come with you, and we'll do a special thing there. We've got some more things. Thanks for the interview, said Emma. I never want to be a flea. I'll be a shark and not a whale. Well done, Emma. Do they have sharks in gambling, Doug?
Oh, I should think so, yeah. But I think most of the sharks are probably wearing tuxedos and running the casinos.
Geeta wants to know, where has been your favourite place to live and why?
You know, I just love everywhere. Wherever I am, I'm very happy.
Happy in your own skin.
Happy in my own skin. I mean, I love it here today in Cyprus. I love the Isle of Man, even when it's raining. I'm quite happy there. I loved Vegas. It was very exciting. But I still have a huge love affair with London.
That's good. Marguerite says, looking forward to reading Hard Fix. Thank you, Marguerite. Brilliant interview. Thank you, Douglas and Humphrey. Geeta says, love that. Happy in your own skin. That was Geeta's question. I think we are. Yes. Time's winged chariot approaches. What a wonderful, inspiring glimpse you've given us into the underbellies of Mayfair, Las Vegas, lore and life. What a great conversation. Thank you all for taking part in that crazy guess that had no real answer to it. And as far as Golster goes, Joe and the team will let you know as soon as we know exactly how things are unfolding. But until Thursday with Lucinda and myself, stay positive, stay calm and carry on. Be generous, stay safe, be curious, and above all, stay new Golster. And thank you so much, Doug Stewart, for alarming us and entertaining us. Best of luck to Ratso, Deadly Hush, and his team of books. And thanks from all of us at Purpose, Passion, and Grit. Bye, Doug. Hope to catch
us. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was great.
Lovely.
Loved it.
Thank you for listening.
and find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Golster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Golster.